Welcome back to the Power Hour, second hour today. Dr. Richard Amerling is joining us. He's a professor, of clinical skills at St. George University School of Medicine. He has a medical degree at the Catholic University in Brussels, Belgium. He's completed his internship and residency at New York Hospital in Queens. He also has a nephrology fellowship, which has to do with kidneys, so we're excited to learn more about that. And he has written the Declaration of Medical Independence, which I'm really excited to hear about. It's been a long time since you've been on, Doc, but welcome back to the Power Hour.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Now, when we first started and Catherine gave me some notes and stuff, and I said, well, what are we going to talk about with Richard? He said, or she said, the state of medicine right now. Now, you're obviously entrenched in the system. We just had a guest on before you who was more of a naturopathic doctor who was talking about the shortcomings in the medical industry. From your perspective, I mean, you're right in the middle of this. What are we looking at? What should we know about the medical industry that we need to be alarmed about?
The medical industry, well, the medical field has been taken over by the industry. That's what we have to be alarmed about. And we are being pushed at every level. And I'm talking about research, journals, education, conferences, and then even the corporate control of medical practice. We're being pushed to practice a certain form of medicine, which involves a tremendous amount of medication prescribing. And this is, I think, creating a public health crisis in that many of the diseases that we are treating are best treated by lifestyle and diet modification and not medications.
Give us an example of something that would be better, lifestyle nutrition modifications. Give us some example.
Well, the biggest and most egregious example is type 2 diabetes. Now, we're in an epidemic of type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes was almost non-existent in the early 1900s and late 1800s. It's a disease of modern civilization, if you will. And it is called type 2 diabetes because it shares something in common with type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is due to lack of insulin. It's actually an autoimmune disease in most patients where the beta cells in the pancreas are attacked and they don't produce insulin. So you cannot get sugar into blood sugar into cells, and you run high blood sugars, and that can cause complications. And the treatment of type 1 diabetes is primarily diet and insulin. The treatment of type 2 diabetes is a totally different, this disease is totally different in that it is due to insulin resistance. The body is producing plenty of insulin, but the cells are not responding to it. And this insulin resistance comes about from overeating sugar and other carbohydrates, which are converted to sugar in the body, and overwhelming the pancreas, forcing it to produce insulin on a near constant basis, and this eventually leads the cells to become resistant to its effect. So you have high blood sugars for a totally different reason. And the treatment for type 2 diabetes ought to be remove the sugar that's provoking this and lower the carbohydrate and sugar intake. And eventually you eliminate this insulin resistance and blood sugars will return to normal through diet. Unfortunately, the same approach to type 2 diabetes, is being used in type 2 diabetes, which is to simply lower the blood sugar with medications, often including insulin. So lowering the blood sugar does not cure the disease. It's curing or treating one symptom or one manifestation of the disease.
You said a word there that probably the interest of a lot of our listeners. You said the word cure. And right. One of the things that we've seen in the medical industry is the word cure is never used. We're not talking about cure anymore. All we're talking about is managing, keeping it within a certain level. We don't hear cure anymore. Why is that?
That's right. Well, because unfortunately, it doesn't really pay the bill to cure a disease. We're talking about managing these chronic diseases. And many of them are related. So, for example, type 2 diabetes is closely related to hypertension, which they coexist very often. It's part of what we call the metabolic syndrome. The metabolic syndrome is described by a brilliant doctor, Gerard Reven, back in the 80s, and describes this combination of insulin resistance, which leads to hypertension, diabetes, and vascular disease, including cardiovascular disease. And in fact, insulin resistance syndrome or metabolic syndrome is the major cause these days of cardiovascular disease. And again, all curable by the proper diet. And I've seen it done. I've done it in my practice numerous times, taking people who have type 2 diabetes on several medications, often including insulin, developing complications of type 2 diabetes, including kidney disease and eye disease, and through intensive dietary management and eventually getting rid of the medications, the diabetes is effectively cured.
You said another word that, you know, probably second to the word cure, seems like it's on the banned list of doctors. You said nutrition. I have experienced and heard so much from our listeners, what have you. Why aren't doctors more trained or aware or whatever word you want to use? Why aren't they talking about nutrition more?
Well, I think more and more are, because it is not a topic that is well covered in medical school. And when it is covered, it is not covered in a way that I think is actually beneficial. In other words, we are still following slavishly this low-fat diet concept that comes about from the epidemiologic work largely of Ansel Keys back in the 60s, leading to the adoption of low-fat diet by the American Heart Association and ultimately promoting the food pyramid from the federal government. As a way to get rid of heart disease or decrease the risk of heart disease. In fact, that was a disaster and ushered in this epidemic of obesity and type 2 diabetes. I call it the crime of the century because short of maybe Mao's China, it's hard to imagine more death and destruction than what has been wrought by this horrendous diet. And all of the patients who develop obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, blindness, kidney failure, peripheral vascular disease with amputations, think of all this. This is millions and millions of people who have been maimed and prematurely killed by faulty dietary advice. And this is, I think, a cautionary tale about the role of government and the role of central authorities in any endeavor, but particularly in health, because if you get it wrong, you are potentially affecting millions of people. And this is the perfect example of how this happened. They got the dietary recommendations wrong. They demonized fat, and they downplayed the toxic effects of sugar and excessive carbohydrates and processed carbohydrates. And you can actually see from about 1980, the rate of obesity just sort of started to go up. And think back to your own experience. Before 1980, there weren't many obese people in the United States. When I was a kid, there was like maybe one chubby kid in the class, in the whole class. Now everybody's overweight in school. If you look back at an old movie, look at the old Dirty Harry movies. I was a big fan of those movies. There isn't an overweight person to be seen in all the extras and all the filming. You see, there's no, everybody's skinny. Go look at Woodstock. the movie. You look out and 500,000 people out there. By the way, I was there. And I was one of the skinny people in the crowd. Right? There was very little obesity in the country back in those days. So this is something that we created by taking fat out of the diet and pushing this idea that you should be eating 50% of your calories as grains, which are carbohydrates.
We got about a minute or so before the break. Now, you got me totally unrelated question I have to ask. So, were you there when Jimi Hendrix played the Star Spangled Banner on Monday?
I didn't make it that far. No, I left early. I just was getting rained out and decided I would bail out. But I missed Jimi Hendrix. But I did see Joe Cocker and his amazing performance of A Little Help from My Friend, which, when you think...
A little air guitar?
Yeah, and that performance was simply one of the best live performances I think ever filmed, ever recorded.
Oh, that's fair. We got about 30 seconds. We got a minute and 30. I have to go there since you brought it up. Besides Joe Cocker, what else stuck with you from that time at Woodstock?
Well, I hate to say, but I didn't really catch anybody else because there was a huge rain delay before he came on. And then it started to rain almost immediately after he went off. And I was there with my brother. We had motorcycled up from the city, and we figured this is going to be really tough getting out of there and getting back. So we bailed out before it got too late. So that was it, Joe Cocker. But I think it was probably one of the best actors in the entire festival.
Well, you picked one of the greatest performances ever. You were there for one of the highlights.
Yeah, true.
Now we're told that they stopped even charging admission. Basically, the people attending pushed down the gates, the rain, and everything. It was like a natural disaster almost there.
It was. Yeah, the fences came down. They stopped charging admission. I actually met later on, became friends with one of the guys who was one of the organizers, and he said the only thing that made money at Woodstock was the food concession. And they were hoping to get a little bit of that. And then all of a sudden, just as they were about to collect that money, a helicopter swooped in and picked it all up. pay for debts or whatever. So these guys made nothing. It was something.
Wow.
Something else, yeah.
Well, there's the music. There's the break. Now, that's a little cultural trivia there. Dr. Richard Amerling was there. We'll be back on the other side. We're going to talk more about the Physicians' Declaration of Independence and other ideas. Dr. Richard Amerling, what a pleasure. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking to Dr. Richard Amerling, who has, you know, a list of accomplishments and skins on the wall that as long as your arm. And he wants to change the way medicine is done. He sees a problem. He's one of the few, but growing. I will say, I think that number is growing. Physicians who have become, unsatisfied with what they've created or what they've been a part of creating, maybe, or what they've seen shoved down their throat. Before the break, we were talking about nutrition, we were talking about diet, we were talking about government regulation getting into medicine. One of the first things you told me was that the medical industry has been taken over and pushed in a certain way. Let's talk about that. What do you mean by that, taken over and pushed in a certain way?
Well, it has been very successfully manipulated to practice a heavy medication-based style of treatment. So, for example, what we just discussed about diabetes, managing the blood sugar as opposed to reversing the disease. Right, managing the blood sugar requires medications that are taken every day for life in literally millions of people. So you can do the math and you realize that you're talking about tens of billions of dollars of sales of these drugs around the world. And in fact, diabetes medications are one of the biggest sellers around the world. Do they actually help people? Well, they don't really. And this is the shocking thing. They treat a symptom of this process, which is high blood sugar. They do not improve life expectancy. They do not decrease cardiovascular death or complications even, but by this approach. So we have been literally brainwashed into thinking that lowering blood sugar with medications and diet, they don't say you shouldn't use diet, but they don't actually prescribe the correct diet to do this, but they're pushing the medication approach, the lowering blood sugar, and saying that this is successful and this is good medical practice. This is managing diabetes successfully. When in fact, you're actually prolonging agony. You're in many cases making people worse because many of these medications that are used to lower the blood sugar have complications, one of which is weight gain. So if a patient has obesity and they develop type 2 diabetes from this obesity as part of this whole metabolic syndrome, to give them a drug that makes them gain weight is obviously a very bad idea. But this is what is being done and pushed as mainstream medical practice. So this is an egregious example.
Let me reverse then. I mean, you're kind of getting into the how, but let me go back at the beginning. How was it taken over? How was it manipulated? Not the actual, the drugs and that, but how was the beginning of the takeover? How did that happen?
Well, now there's speculation because, of course, there's no smoking memo. Let me just give you some dots. But then your listeners can start to connect. Pharma. There is this group, PHRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturer Association. So you could look at this as a cartel. There are, I think, the 30 top big pharma companies have a trade organization. So I look at this as a cartel. I think that they probably do get together and they discuss strategies. There has been a movement that has been crucial in getting this takeover going, which is called evidence-based medicine. And evidence-based medicine started to come into existence in the early 90s. And what it was a movement to try to use scientific research to rationalize the practice of medicine. Now, medicine had a rational basis well before evidence-based medicine. That was science. In other words, the basic science which undergirds medical thinking and medical decision-making was there. So evidence-based medicine came after that. And what they attempt to do is to take studies and apply the results of these studies to medical treatment. There are several problems with this approach. One is that they have a hierarchy of studies and data. So is there evidence with at the very top what are called randomized controlled trials. Now, randomized controlled trials are where you take two groups that are randomized, so they're similar to populations. You give one group drug A, you give the other group either a placebo or drug B, and you follow them over time. You see who does whether the drug works or not. So randomized controlled trials actually are important studies to see if drugs are effective.
Hold that thought, Doc. Before the break, Dr. Amerling, you were talking about science versus evidence-based medicine. It sounded to me,
right.
I want you to get into a little more detail. It sounds to me almost like the same thing that went on with law. We went somewhere in America from constitutional law then to case law. It's like constitutional law was... the Constitution was a law. Now the case law, and now they interpreted it. Now it became manipulative or manipulatable. It kind of sounds like a similar thing with science here.
Yeah, it could be. Let me give you some examples so you'll have a better idea what I'm getting at here. So I was talking about the randomized controlled study and how that is the top of the hierarchy of evidence-based medicine. And by the way, down at the bottom is clinical experience. Now, that gives me a problem because I'm an experienced clinician, and my clinical experience, I think, should count for something. And I think that everybody would agree with that. If you have a difficult medical problem, you don't want to go to someone fresh out of their internship necessarily. You want to go to the physician who has the most experience treating that disease, particularly, right? So, you wouldn't want to go to a new graduate for someone with advanced kidney failure. You want to come to see me, who has 30 plus years of experience with advanced kidney failure. You get the idea. So that's another problem. So let's take an example. So the randomized controlled trials, typically you have thousands of subjects or patients in each group, and you're comparing, some outcomes from different treatments. Now, let's say you have a drug that produces an extremely tiny benefit, such as, let's say the statin drugs, okay? The statin drugs are widely overprescribed. They have extremely limited efficacy. They lower cholesterol, but they do not extend life in most patients who take them. But this is how this works. You have a difference, let's say, you have one group that has 95% survival. In other words, 5% over 5 years died of a heart attack, let's say. Okay? The other group has 96 that survived, 4 that died. Right? So there's literally a 1% difference in mortality between the two groups. But that is actually a 20% risk reduction. Okay, you see what I'm getting at here, right?
Yes, so yes, it's statistics. They're manipulating statistics.
Yeah, 5% versus 4% is a 20% relative reduction of risk. That sounds...
Well, and they have the money. Yeah, they can do study after study, and they get 100 people and 100 people. Who knows what studies they didn't publish, and then, only 4 died in this one. This is a study we published.
That's right. That's right. So they can manipulate the numbers of subjects. They can plan how many subjects they need to get a statistically significant result from their minimal effect. And report it as a major breakthrough, when in fact it's a clinically trivial effect. And this is what has been done for statins and hypertension drugs and diabetes drugs. This manipulation by using this relative risk reduction concept versus actual risk reduction. And this has ended up with hundreds of thousands, millions of patients taking these drugs for years and years, their entire lives sometimes, and not getting any benefit. Okay?
So are statins drug ever prescribed? Because I've heard other doctors have said that on this air. Is that pretty much worst drug ever?
Well, I think the statins as a class are really more harmful than good. I base this on the, first of all, the biochemistry of how the drugs work, and this is an example of, again, going back to basic science. If you look at the biosynthesis of cholesterol, the statins work on an enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase, which is at the very early stage of cholesterol biosynthesis. So not only does it disrupt cholesterol biosynthesis, but it also interrupts synthesis of coenzyme Q10 of the quinone class of vitamins. And then cholesterol itself is used as the backbone for vitamin D synthesis. It's used as the backbone for all the steroid hormones, cortisone, testosterone, estrogen. All these come from cholesterol. So if you just look at this, you would say, why would I ever want to inhibit the biosynthesis of cholesterol? It just simply cannot be a good thing. So that's just one way to look at it. And, of course, the results with cholesterol lowering are dismal. They do not prolong life, okay? They do not save lives, as people claim. So let me give you a quote, because I just looked this up because I'm using this in a talk, which I'm doing in Indianapolis. This is from Marcia Angel, who is no radical, okay? She is an eminent doctor. She was editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, the most prestigious journal in the world, probably at this point, maybe The Lancet. This is what she writes, and she is writing about how psychiatric medications, and this is a whole can of worms too, the way psychiatric medications have been studied in the literature and selectively reported and results spun and just a mess. And so she writes, I'm quoting now, similar conflicts of interest and biases exist in virtually every field of medicine, particularly those that rely heavily on drugs or devices. It is simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines. I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reached slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine. And I have to say that this is how I came to my position, too. I started out as a optimistic young physician prescribing statins and all these medications willy-nilly. And then I realized over time that these were not working. These were not saving anybody. And in the case of diabetes, we're actually making people worse. And I changed my perspective, my point of view, and I saw how these companies influence policy by affecting the research. They sponsor the majority of the trials. They selectively publish the trials that are favorable to their products. They suppress the research and other findings, other trials that don't support their drugs. They influence the composition of guideline panels. The majority of panelists, medical panels who create guidelines do have financial conflicts of interest where they are paid by the drug companies. And this is glaring. I mean, this is just outrageously obvious that they cannot possibly, even if they declare these conflicts of interest, they cannot eliminate the bias. And the bias is evident. It's dripping in every word of these guidelines. You can see that they actually believe, for example, in the cholesterol guidelines, that there is no cholesterol too low. That cannot possibly be true, right? Why would our body manufacture a substance that you then want to actually eliminate by a drug? It can't possibly be beneficial, and it isn't. It isn't. In fact, it's harmful.
There's the break, Doc. There's the music for the break. Let me just ask you just real quick. We have one segment left. Such good information. Are your fellow physicians, are they starting to come around to your way of thinking here? Yes or no?
Some are, and I'll tell you some of them. I'll tell you about some of them.
Okay, do you, yeah. Well, we'll get on the other side. I got a question on the other side. Dr. Richard Amerling is proof of the adage, seek and ye shall find. If you're looking for a doctor who thinks outside the box, not one that's just totally entrenched in this pharmacological haze that the rest of America seems to be in, look, here he is. Here's one of them. It can be done. One of the things we didn't discuss too much about Dr. Amerling is his work. He teaches at the college there in Grenada. And I asked him during the break, and I'll ask him now on air, Dr. Amerling, do you take concepts that you're talking to us about, do you teach them in to your medical students?
I do. What I do is I try to get my students to think and reason scientifically and to question dogma. And there's so much dogma out there, particularly regarding diet, the whole lipid hypothesis, which is really up for grabs at this point. We still very poorly understand lipids, how they interact with vessel walls, et cetera. But certainly it's absolutely ridiculous to think that just high cholesterol causes vascular injury, but that simply is just not the case. And anyway, so I do go into this. I'm trying to put together a selective course that students can take as an option where I go into what I call science-based medicine and go disease by disease through how evidence-based medicine views a certain disease, let's say diabetes, and how science-based medicine views it in another way, and let them come to their own conclusions about which is superior in terms of getting patients healthy again, which should be our goal. Our goal should not be to manage a chronic disease. It should be to restore good health, and that's another thing that I try to emphasize. I wanted to give a shout-out because, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead. Go ahead with your shout-out. Go ahead.
There are several people who have influenced me greatly and who are, I think, on the cutting edge of this whole movement. And this is a very growing movement of challenging the diet dogma, the statin dogma, et cetera. And so some of the people who have been tremendous, Gary Taubes, you gotta give a hat tip to Gary Taubes. He wrote some very influential books showing how really it was sugar that was killing us as opposed to fat. Nina Teichel, another journalist who wrote a tremendous book called The Big Fat Surprise that shows how the anti-fat dogma came out of just junk science. There was no hard evidence that low fat was healthy. In fact, just the opposite. And then there are several doctors who I like a lot. Jason Fung, who's a nephrology colleague of mine from Toronto, has a couple of excellent books out, The Obesity Code and The Diabetes Code. And it's funny because he came to this exactly the way I did, by seeing all these patients with kidney failure from diabetes getting worse and worse on the standard treatment and standard diet. Asim Malhotra is a cardiologist based in the UK who has come out strongly against the lipid hypothesis and statin use. Brett Scher is another cardiologist who has an anti-statin position. David Diamond. These guys have done tremendous work, and they're available on Twitter, and I suggest that people follow them and get into this whole movement, because education is the key to this. It's not going to come from industry, and it's certainly not going to come from the government. We have to just do this ourselves, get the word out about how we've been hijacked, how medicine has been hijacked. And individual patients are taking matters into their own hands. And every day I read about another patient who has cured their diabetes, gotten rid of their medications through adopting a low-carb, high-fat diet. So,
ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't realized that your health is your responsibility, we just got a few more minutes, Dr. Amerling. I got a couple more questions for you, and then I'll leave final thoughts to you. I got to get this question in. Just about every doctor like you who comes on asking this question. The third leading cause of death in America is some kind of medical mistake. We were 37th, I believe, in overall health in the world. Now we're down to 43 in 1 year. We're the only developed nation that I know of, as far as I can tell, whose life expectancy the last 2 years has actually went down, while every other developed country is going up. I mean, with all these things, everything that you have seen, if I'm a patient and I'm looking at the medical establishment, medical industry, what have you, what grade would you give it?
We've got to be a D at this point. We have some amazing things going on in medicine. There's no denying there's some great stuff going on. But overall, we are over-treating patients with drugs that are toxic. And I'm not aware that our mortality has gotten worse. I mean, our life expectancy has gone down. But I believe you if you tell me that's the latest number.
Last 2 years.
It's scary.
The last two years, it's barely went down, yes.
It's not surprising if you consider the number of people who are now significantly obese, who now have type 2 diabetes, who are being treated with drugs that actually make them worse as opposed to diet, which is going to cure them. It's not surprising that our mortality is going up. All these people who are being given statins that don't produce any benefit and may actually be toxic to their muscle, possibly even to their heart muscle, then this can also be behind a worsened life expectancy in the country. Go ahead.
Last question. Somebody who's listening, they don't really think like you do, or they think like you do, but maybe their loved one doesn't, and they have some medical problem that they need to seek some advice on. What advice would you give to them to help their loved one?
Well, you need to find an independent, free-thinking doctor, and that is probably not going to be someone who's working in the corporate system. And that's another reason why I think physicians need to stay independent. They have to be able to practice according to their own scientific structure and their own core beliefs about what constitutes good health and how to achieve good health. And if they're just going to be clicking boxes on electronic health records and blindly prescribing based on numbers, such as the blood sugar, such as the blood cholesterol level, they're going to be doing harm. They're going to be treating patients as a population as opposed to individuals. And that's what I try to push back against.
We got about a minute or so, maybe half a minute. Last thought is all yours.
Well, yeah. I mean, so the scientific approach, as I was getting into, if you're just treating based on a population study, you may get misled. But if I take a patient and I see that they're doing horribly with type 2 diabetes and kidney disease, I take them off their medication and cure them with diet, and their kidney disease abates, is that not scientific?
Well, you would think. Well, you would think, Doc. There's the end of the show. God bless you, my friend. Great information. Keep doing what you're doing.